Hello, Susanna Lopez here, actor turned barrister turned broadcaster turned true crime writer and proud member of Sisters in Crime Australia. Welcome to the Scarlet Stiletto Bites podcast. For over 30 years now, Sisters in Crime Australia has supported our women crime writers, both true crime and fiction, and some criminal literary talent has been unearthed. Among many awards, there's an annual prize for short crime fiction, the Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And for those of you who prefer your stories by ear, in 2023 we commenced this podcast series, Scarlet Stiletto Bites, to celebrate the sisters' 30th anniversary. Each story is short, but not always sweet. Expect twisted tales, quirky humour, and a frisson of feminism. Please support us by following, sharing, reviewing, and generally spreading the word. We have no paywall. Sometimes art gets, shall we say, too close to the bone. As in today's story, Fallen Angel by Candace Graham. Scarlet Stiletto Environmental Theme Award 2012. I enjoy working at night. While my house is locked and silent, the loft thrives in activity. I tie my greying hair in a rough ponytail and roll up the sleeves of my old loose shirt. I'm wearing a watch but no rings and a pair of glasses strung round my neck. To my back, I have several wooden benches with half-finished creations of less pertinent work and completed projects wrapped in plastic and ready for transport. To my front are wall-to-floor windows. I like watching the nocturnal movements, the dwindling traffic, and the orange glow of building lights before they gradually flick out. My old Samoyed dog, Chachi, is asleep under the desk at my feet, his fluffy white fur better than any pair of slippers I've ever owned. My tools are those of my artist's trade, a selection for moulding and cutting clay, rollers and a container of water. But there are distinctions. My current project moves beyond fantasy. There is a microscope on the desk and two lamps that I can angle to my advantage. One is a magnifier lamp, similar to those you may have come across in a dentist's office. There are posters of human anatomy and muscle structure on the walls beside me, most of which I committed to memory years ago. Still, it helps to put them up so people recognize your expertise. My real crowd pleaser is the plastic teaching model of a torso and head, dubbed George, whose muscle structure is visible for all to see. A cardboard box rests center stage on my workbench. It contains a plastic bag, notes attached, with an unbroken blue seal. I break the seal and withdraw a human skull. Caucasian, female and fairly young. The medical examiner estimated around 20 years old. No personal effects were found with the remains, which were dumped naked in a muddy creek bed. The recent drought caused the creek to dry up and the earth relinquished its grip on her. Aspects of her skeleton were exposed and bleached in the sun before she was found by some children camping with their parents in the national park. I take the skull out and feel the smooth bone in my hands, gently turning her from side to side. Some people like to do sketches, but I prefer to feel a thing in my hands. I visualize the process I'm about to undertake, examining the skull thoroughly. Then, with the utmost care, I wash the skull with a damp sponge and repair a shattered fragment over the occipital lobe by filling in the hole with wax and smoothing it to match the line of the parietal bone. I fill the nasal cavity, the eye sockets with modelling clay, and carefully examine the arrangement of the teeth before attaching the mandible to the skull with wax. Finally, I create a cast of the repaired skull. Soon, I'll be replaced by computer software programs. They're getting more accurate by the day, and eventually they may even meet the Daubert standard and be accepted in court. The artist in me finds it hard to believe a soulless thing could truly capture the essence of a person, but the scientist accepts my ill-destined fate in the path of progress. I'm already semi-retired and these days focus more on art than forensic anthropology, but those who have previously used the services of the renowned Aletta Castine swear by my practice. Cold cases such as this provide a welcome reprieve from museum projects. The cast does not feel familiar between my hands, but I will work towards restoring a familiarity for her. Once I've gotten a feel for her, my ritual descends to trance. I look more critically at her bone structure and place plastic markers on the skull to map out her distinctive landmarks. Tissue depth has to be estimated based on her demographics. I work my way along the cheeks and lips, using my wooden tools to draw the angles and lines of the muscle fibres. Then I work on her eyes, nose and ears. When I can no longer safely hold her in my hands, she's fastened to a wooden block and stand. She sits securely on my desk, angled so that we are face to face. It isn't until the final stages, when I smooth out her skin and form an unobtrusive hairline, I realize I've instilled too much familiarity. I know this woman. When young Constable Benson arrives the next morning to collect my work, he is met by an unexpected frenzy. I have cleared my middle workbench of artworks and amassed piles of old storage boxes stacked with albums. I lead him to them, passing withdrawn photos into his hands, one after the other. Angela Durand, I say, pointing to the facial reconstruction watching over us. The last time I saw her, she was only 15, but she looked so much like my half-sister, I know it has to be her. What's all this? Constable Benson asks, failing to catch my preformed train of thought. The bones belong to my niece. My visit to the police station makes me unexpectedly nervous. I describe Angela's disappearance 6 years ago, explain the rumours that she had run off with an older man. Her father died when she was 4. My half-sister, Jennifer Durand, Jenna, was killed 3 weeks ago by a hit and run. I am Jenna's only known relative. Everything in her estate has been left to me to hold on to in the hope that it could pass to her daughter when she is located. Senior Sergeant Albert narrows her eyes during my story. She asks whether I had taken time off after Jenna's death, whether such a recent tragedy could have affected my work, but I remain resolute. She sighs and leans back in her chair. Okay, Aletta, we'll try and obtain her dental records for a comparison, but it will take time. I visit Jenna's house. It feels odd, as though I am intruding upon a stranger's privacy. Jenna has converted Angela's old room into an investigation headquarters. There are various documents on the desk and labelled boxes on the floor. I open one box containing Angela's old law textbooks and university lectures, used pencils and pens, and some photos of Angela with her friends on campus. She looks stunning. Braced against the wind, dark hair the only trademark of her father. Her figure and facial structure resemble Jenna, who acquired her beauty from our mother, while I inherited my father's genes. My parents migrated from Holland when I was 5 years old. Shortly after, my mother left us for an Australian man and gave birth to Jenna. It was a tenuous relationship to begin with, so it was unsurprising that Jenna and I had gradually drifted apart. I wonder how long she must have spent collecting these piles of documents, and I feel ashamed for my absence. I wonder what I should do with it all now. She was very bright, says Shanti, her dark eyes solemn. Yeah, a real know-it-all, adds Vicky, casually brushing her hair from her shoulder. The two young women sitting before me were friends of Angela's. I found their names on the back of the university photos. Jenna had included their details in a journal, listing their current employment at a small law firm downtown, and they agreed to meet me during their lunch break. Angela was last seen at the university dormitory. Her room contained no signs of a struggle, but was missing a bag and some clothes. This, no doubt, supported the idea that she had run away due to the pressures of her course. You wouldn't find Angela working in a dump like this, says Vicky, lighting up a smoke. She was a real prize to be won. You know, lots of law firms were interested in her, inviting her to interstate conferences, out for drinks and fancy balls. She had a lot of sugar daddies. It wasn't like that, interjects Shanti. She helped organise balls for charity events. What was the last one she did? I ask. Shanti pauses, dragging up memories like bones from dried mud. The Grimbold and Ephrain ball, collecting money for Angel Flight. Grimbold and Ephrain? A real prestigious law firm. Probably the one Angela would have been working at. She was doing an internship there at the time she went missing. Once home, I make myself a cup of tea. Chachi shadows my movements and settles under the coffee table. I pull out my laptop and look up Angel Flight, an operation that during times of non-emergency transports individuals in medical and financial need from rural Australia. Angela must have been an earth angel, someone who helps out on the ground level with things like collecting donations. I look up Grimbold and Ephrain, now Grimbold, Ephrain and Ransford, and bring up a link to the annual charity auction ball. Photos of previous events show stereotypical lawyers, male, old, and plump round the middle. I picture Jenna huddled for hours over her research. Then I notice maps plotting out Grimbold, Ephrain, and Ransford office locations. One location is 2 blocks from where Gemma was killed by the hit and run. I turn off my laptop and head to my studio, pulling out various materials onto my last remaining bench, located furthest from the window. My first step is making a small clay model. In the morning, I will order some Australian blue marble. It takes a few days for my marble block to arrive at a friend's warehouse. When I travel there, it is wet and raining. I have somewhere else to stop on the way. Everything about the Grimbold, Ephrain and Ransford office building indicates expense. The parking is for clients only, but I notice a sign indicating public parking further down the road. I fight to keep hold of my large blue umbrella as I walk over the pedestrian crossing, but find myself standing still in the middle of the road. This is where Jenna was struck and killed. Drivers beep their horns at me. Flustered, I reach the other side of the road and pause next to a tall building with old architectural features. There was only one reported witness, a drunken homeless man, who said he saw a dark-coloured and expensive-looking car, possibly a Mercedes, hit Jenna at the crossing and failed to stop. My eyes scan the edges of buildings. There is only one person, so easy to have passed by, buried under blankets in the entryway of an office listed for sale. As I approach him, my palms are sweaty. He's sleeping and I need to touch his back in order to wake him. When he turns, I instinctively step back a pace. Underneath a thick beard, his face is scarred, his eyes bloodshot. "What you want?" he growls, and I fear I have woken an angry bear. When his eyes focus on me and assess that I am not at all threatening, he changes his tune. "Got any money?" I'm here to ask about what you saw 3 weeks ago. You saw a woman hit by a car here at this crossing.
What?
He cannot process my words.
I wasn't here 3 weeks ago. This was Jimmy's spot, but it's mine now.
He pulls the blankets close to him. He wants to go back to sleep, but I try pushing a little further. Where is Jimmy now?
He ain't here anymore.
He's dead? I ask, shocked.
Nah, not dead. He's moved up in the world, Jimmy has. Too good for us now, he has a little. He has a flat out near the train tracks.
Do you know the address? I ask as he lies his head back down.
Nah, leave me alone, woman. I don't want to sleep.
As he curls himself back up in his blankets, I pull out a $20 note and reach over him to tuck it into his hand. He clasps it tightly and nods his head in appreciation, and it disappears under the blankets. He stinks of booze, and I do hope that the money goes toward buying a good meal rather than a bottle. I reach my friend's workshop and, with borrowed power tools, set to work on my newly acquired blue marble. The noise of the machines blocks out the world, and I think about Jenna on the crossing. I think about a dark-coloured Mercedes speeding away. I think about Jimmy and how he managed to get enough money to leave the streets and move into a flat. With every thought, a fraction of the marble begins to take shape. I transport her to my studio when her basic form has appeared from the stone. I don't have the appropriate ventilation at the studio to use power tools, so it's back to traditional methods, chisels, rasps and rifflers. Thinking of the dust, I cover my workbenches in old sheets before I begin, and Chachi hides out beneath them like a polar bear in his cave. I mark out with charcoal areas to remove, carefully tracing out the lines. It is amazing, the similarity between the bones in our arms and hands and those in a bird's wing. I map them out with my fingers and label them in my mind. Humerus, ulna, radius, carpal, metacarpal, phalanges. When I'm happy with my progress, I ring my agent Clara and ask her to set up the arrangements. She's confused by my detailed request at first, but promises to look into it right away. It is short notice, but I know that my offer won't be refused. Nobody refuses a donation. My charity, however, serves an ulterior motive. It secures me a ticket. The Grimbold Ephraim and Rainsford Charity Auction Ball is a glamorous affair, and I sense that I'm somewhat out of place in my hastily bought full-length ball gown. I feel rather exposed, deprived of my casual clothes, stained in artist's clay. The hall has been tastefully decorated in black and gold, with auction items located around the perimeter for viewing before the bidding begins. My donation was too large to place on the sidelines and has instead managed to obtain centre stage beneath the crescent stone staircase. I couldn't imagine a better place for her. She stands proud at 5'8" to her head, another foot to the tip of her curved wings. Angelic Messenger, the caption reads, kindly donated by artist Aletta Castian. Proceeds will be donated to Angel Flight. I have her carved in a silk gown, one hand clasped to her chest, the other outstretched towards the assembly gathered below. The marble gives her skin an ethereal translucency, and though the resemblance has been kept subtle, she looks upon the crowd with Angela's gentle face. I meet volunteers, Karen and Manu from Angel Flight, and take note when they mention deceased estates can be donated. Manu, a pilot, appears bewitched by my statue, commenting he has always appreciated stonework. He is about 6 foot with broad shoulders, dark features, and skin the same colour as my modelling clay. He notes that I am unaccompanied. No men in your life then, Aletta? I consider my response thoughtfully. Well, there is one. Fantastic sense of humour, great listener, pity he can't cook, no opposable thumbs. Manu looks baffled, while Karen starts to giggle. The only man in my life is my dog, I explain. My interest peaks when I meet the named partners. Kenneth Ephraim has bright blue eyes and silver hair. His appropriately beguiling trophy wife Nada is permanently attached to his arm and scathingly eyes her younger counterparts. Hunter Grimbold is short and portly, unmarried, accompanied by 20-something intern Denisha. She's dark-haired and gorgeous, with perfect teeth and a glass of wine constantly in hand. James Daniel Ransford is thin and lean like a hungry dog, 10 years younger than the original partners, but already going grey at the edges. All the male lawyers look enthralled by my creation, and I keenly watch their eyes linger over her. I try to imagine Angela among these strangers. The young women are very popular. As Denisha goes looking for another drink, I notice she's cornered by Manu for several minutes. I catch her in the ladies' room freshening up and casually mention Manu's name. He was trying to tell me about his job helping rural Australia and how good it is camping out in the bush, how beautiful it is out there. She rolls her eyes. Give me a 5-star hotel any day. We have a lot of rural clients, all mud and flies and horseshit out there. I idly wonder whether there are any rural clients in the stalls to overhear her loosened tongue. As the auction begins, I choose a seat near the back with a clear view. The Angelic Messenger draws numerous bids. Manu opens the round, but the price quickly rises above his pay grade. Some clients pitch in. Ephraim bids once, before being reprimanded by his wife, and it finally comes down to a battle between Grimbald and Ransford. With competitive undertones seeping in, neither man is keen to back down. The auction doesn't end until Denisha spills her latest glass of wine on Grimbald's shoes. He is furious at his loss, but manages the last word. I overhear him snigger to Ransford. That's okay, James. I'll just have to settle for the real thing. He leaves with a tight grip on Denisha's arm. I had not planned on participating. However, I raise my number for a charity flight package with Manu and take out the winning bid. You ever been flying before? Asks Manu, starting up the motor of his light aircraft. In a passenger jet, I respond, noting the immediacy of this experience. I can feel every movement of the plane as it splutters and vibrates around us. There are four passengers in the back, patients and carers, but Manu has seated me next to him in the cockpit. Unlike at the charity ball, he is now in his element. As the runway disappears from beneath us, I try to hide the fact that I'm having a hot flush and distract myself with memories of the charity auction. Transporting marble can be tricky, so I approached Ransford to discuss my recommended courier options. He confessed he did not yet know where to place the sculpture. He was about to embark interstate for business, and the auction house could not hold items long term. I volunteered to have the angel return to my studio until appropriate arrangements could be made regarding her permanent location. Ransford also expressed an interest in commissioning further works, so we agreed a tour of my workspace would be merited upon his return. After the ball, I stayed online for hours, looking up the national park where Angela's body was found. I dug up sales records for the properties in the nearby towns. And I found out what properties were bought and sold 6 years ago. I emailed local real estate agents asking whether Grimbald and Ephraim were involved in the conveyancing. One property, located on the border of the national park, ticked all the boxes. When I found out Angel Flight did regular trips to the town, I knew it was time to cash in my charity purchase. I try to keep my voice casual as I talk to Manu about camping sites. It seems appropriate listening to him talking about the land as we fly high above its topography, mapped out like a patchwork quilt. He is very passionate about his hobby and about his volunteer work with Angel Flight. It isn't until several hours later, when we're back on the ground, that I discover he has only been a volunteer for 2 years, having previously been living and working in Polynesia. I spend one night in a crooked and flea-infested bed before hiring the hotel owner's car and driving out to the Fenwick farm. It's impossibly early, the sun has not yet risen, and the roads are treacherous. There's no one at the gate, so I have to open and close it myself. I pull up the drive and park next to the large milking barns. The earth smells of cows and manure. Mr. Fenwick emerges. A letter? Oh, wait, we're just in the process of milking them. Let me show you. He pulls open the barn doors and the cacophony overwhelms me. The cows are lined up and harnessed into automatic milkers. As we walk, Mr. Fenwick describes a vivid history depicting a thriving dairy farm. The Fenwicks purchased it 6 years ago because, well, they wanted to raise their children in the country. The back paddocks used to be marshland and rivers flowed through the property, but then the drought hit. There isn't enough for them to eat in the fields, and purchasing feed is expensive, comments Fenwick, watching his herd. Their milk production has dropped. Looking closer, I can see the skin is tight on their bones. Ribs jut out from their chests, and there's a swelling around their necks. "Ah, it was a real effort getting in all the cows," says Fenwick.
"Oh, they didn't sell you the cows with the property?"
"No, I think the lawyers might have advised them to sell the cows separately to make more money. Only no one around here bought any or knows where they ended up."
"Did you ever meet the lawyers?" I ask.
"Only once or twice," he scratches his head. "Man and a young woman, an intern, I think. I'm sorry, I don't remember their names." I pull out a photo of Angela, and Fenwick nods. It was a long time ago. That could be her." On my way back to the hotel, I try to picture a prosperous dairy farm with lush pastures. Wouldn't it have been easier to sell the previous cows with the property? What reason would necessitate the disappearance of a herd of cattle? The town has a small library with books catered to its demographic: agriculture, cultivation, land care, and a substantial section on romantic fantasy for the women. I pull out a collection of books on dairy farming and spread them out on a back table. I've never read anything on the topic before, so my progress is slow and I tire quickly. I can just picture the young staff member approaching the body in the library, cautiously reaching out her trembling hand. When I feel her gentle touch on my shoulder, I abruptly reanimate and she shrieks. I'm sorry, rough night," I explain. "Is there anything I could help you with?" she inquires, composing herself once more.
Actually, yes. What would be a reason to destroy a herd of cattle?"
Her expression is puzzled.
"What, you mean if they're diseased or something?"
"Exactly," I say, so enthusiastically that I startle her all over again. Alice diligently brings me volumes on viruses and bacteria affecting cattle. Within their pages, I come across Jones disease, caused by Mycobacterium parotuberculosis. Signs of infection appear during times of stress, such as drought. Symptoms include weight loss, despite a healthy appetite, chronic diarrhea, and a distinctive bottle jaw swelling. Contaminated manure taints the environment, particularly the water systems, and the bacteria can be passed from mother's milk to calf. There is no cure. Antibiotics could temporarily hide the symptoms, but the cattle would inescapably die. The bacteria can survive independently for a year in a favourable environment, such as a marshland, tainting the entire property. Even novice farmers could recognise extraordinarily unhealthy animals, and if a veterinarian were called in, the property sale may be frozen for an extended and costly quarantine.
"It's fraud," I say. "They knew what was happening, but they tried to conceal it."
Alice looks confused. I pass the books into her hands. "Could you photocopy these and pass them on to the Fenwicks?" Angela's body had been dumped in a river, perhaps because the killer was not physically capable of digging a hole to bury her. My mind drifts to the grey-haired and arthritic lawyers in their expensive suits. I cannot picture them constructing a well-dug grave.
Chachi is sulking when I pick him up the next day from the neighbours. When we climb to my studio, he quickly takes up a position under one of the still-covered workbenches. Angelic Messenger is waiting for me, carefully wrapped in plastic.
Mr. Ransford arrives late in the evening, after work hours, to discuss her transportation and further works. From my phone in the studio, I can buzz him into the building, and he arrives up the studio steps looking flustered.
Sorry, I get asthma, he explains,
then smiles when he sees the angel's rapt figure against the back wall. There's just something about her. It's a marvellous piece. Has Mr. Grimbold forgiven you for winning the auction? I ask casually.
Oh, no. He's never liked me much, he speaks freely. I don't think he wanted me as a partner, but I have a large list of clients devoted to me, and Kenneth knew I was a valuable asset. I make a lot of money for the firm. Grimbold still keeps me at a distance, though, and that's why it took me so long to drive here. I tend to work at our second largest office, down on Merrick Street.
Yes, I say, moving over to the windows and noting the black Mercedes parked below. I'm aware of that particular office. Oh, have you done business with us before? A relative of mine was involved in some of your rural work, involving selling a dairy farm. He points his finger at me.
Now see, that's what I'm talking about. Extending to rural clientele was one of my initiatives. There's a lot of money to be made in that area.
Yes, I say. I imagine there is.
Can I have another look at her? Ransford gestures to the statue.
I extend my arm by way of permission, and he unfolds the plastic like a child eagerly unwrapping a Christmas present. As layers of her skin become visible, he inquires about her construction once more.
Did you use a model to base her on? I'd love to meet her.
As I move closer to him, I reach under one of the dusty sheets and extract my photo album, remove a picture and hand it to him. He takes it keenly and examines the 15-year-old girl.
Oh, she looks too young.
His expression starts to shift as his eyes linger on the lines of her face, her hair, her eyes.
I wonder if Ransford has always been jealous of Grimbold's pretty young companions. Perhaps he hoped to acquire one of his own. Was he motivated by more than just fraud?
I picture him burning Angela's clothes with the cattle.
Did you know I just recently spent some time in the country?
I ask, blood boiling.
I met some interesting people at the Fenwick Dairy Farm. Their business isn't going too well, but I'm sure you would have already known that. I've made a serious error. Before I can finish my sentence, James Daniel Ransford has raised his arm and hit me with a backhand, the photo falling from his fingers next to me as I hit the floor. I should have been expecting an abrupt assault. I think of Jenna confronting Ransford, only to be struck down by his car. When Ransford moves to stand over me, I kick hard at his ankles. He loses his balance and falls into Angela's statue, causing her to come crashing down with the weight of him. I use my arms to protect myself against the falling marble. It hits the concrete floor beside me and breaks along various fault lines. Pieces slide out across the ground around me. Ransford is bruised and wheezing heavily, but he is not beaten. I try to rise, but he pulls me back to the floor. One arm pins me. The other collects the plastic wrapping and holds it over my mouth and nose. The arm holding me down is too strong for me to push away. Through the confusion, I see a white blur approaching rapidly from behind. Woken from the noise, Chachi emerges and latches onto Ransford's right arm with strength, I thought, beyond a dog of his years. Ransford screams in pain. I reach behind me, grasping wildly, until I unexpectedly take a hand in mine. It's Angela's hand,
The marble is broken just above the forearm. With the force of three women, I swing that marble in a sharp arc into Ransford's skull at the temporal lobe. The bone cracks violently, and he hits the concrete floor with a thud. There's no further movement except for his blood, which drains out beneath him. Chachi releases Ransford's limp arm and licks my face. As I lie still on the floor, looking into Angela's marble face, so similar to the reconstruction I began with, I gradually realize the phone is ringing. There's a small click as it switches to messages.
Hello, Aletta. It's Constable Benson here. I was just calling to say we have the dental records and can confirm the body belongs to Angela Durand. We'd like you to come into the station tomorrow so we can properly start the investigation.
The end.
Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to get your feedback and we'd love to reach more listeners. Our website is sistersincrime.org.au and our email address is admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Until next Friday then, when we bring you another scintillating story from Australian women crime creators.